Friedrich Karl Berger was a guard at one of the Nazi concentration camps, who for 70 years after the end of World War II managed to conceal his past. Having escaped from Germany to Canada and then on to the United States, he continued to live off his pension for service to the German Navy. In November 2020, at the age of 94, he was arrested and deported to Germany to stand trial for his past offences. In March of this year, 2021, German prosecutors dropped the case against him, citing lack of evidence. But even had they not done so, and Berger been found guilty and sentenced to spend the remainder of his days in a German prison cell, would justice have really been done? I hardly think so. Punishment would have come too late and would no doubt have been too light to be any way meaningful. There are many in our world today who dislike the idea of God being a God of judgment, and that includes many within the church. A lot of contemporary theologians and professing Christians welcome, of course, they welcome the picture of a God of love, but not one of wrath or vengeance. Thus, we have notions like universalism, that in the end, everyone will be saved. Also, concepts like propitiation and substitution, that God poured out his wrath on his Son in our place, are under attack, viewed as being incompatible with a loving and forgiving God, epitomized, of course, by a meek and mild Jesus. But I wonder how you would feel about it if you had been the victim of some heinous crime, like the rape of your child. I suspect that in that case, you would want to see justice being done, with the perpetrator of the atrocity brought to book. And if it were not to happen in this life because the perpetrator escaped the forces of law and order, or maybe died an old man after living a comfortable life, I suspect you would want to believe that there will be an eternal day of reckoning. I know I wouldn't wish to worship a God who turned a blind eye to injustice, who simply let people off with their evil deeds. Of course, forgiveness is always on offer in this life for the sinner who repents, who genuinely repents. But the idea that God will not punish evil is, I think, offensive to any right-thinking person's sense of morality. God is a holy God, and his holiness demands that justice be done. That's indeed the reason why his Son was put to death. For if there had been no cross, then there'd have to be eternal punishment for everyone, for all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. Certainly the God we're presented with in Habakkuk chapter 2 is far from being a soft touch. Rather, he's very much a God of judgment. This will become more than clear from today's reading, which we'll turn to now. So it is Habakkuk chapter 2, and we're going to read from verse 4 to the end of the chapter. See, he is puffed up. His desires are not upright, but the righteous will live by his faith. Indeed, wine betrays him. He is arrogant and never at rest, because he is as greedy as the grave, and like death is never satisfied. He gathers to himself all the nations and takes captive all the peoples. Will not all of them taunt him with ridicule and scorn, saying, "Woe to him who piles up stolen goods and makes himself wealthy by extortion. How long must this go on? Will not your debtors suddenly arise? Will they not wake up and make you tremble? Then you will become their victim. Because you have plundered many nations, the peoples who are left will plunder you. For you have shed man's blood. You have destroyed lands and cities and everyone in them. Woe to him who builds his realm by unjust gain, to set his nest on high, to escape the clutches of ruin. You have plotted the ruin of many peoples, claiming your own house, shaming your own house, and forfeiting your life. The stones of the wall will cry out, and the beams of the woodwork will echo it. Woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed and establishes a town by crime. Has not the Lord Almighty determined that the people's labor is only fuel for the fire, that the nations exhaust themselves for nothing? For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Woe to him who gives drink to his neighbors, pouring it from the wineskin till they are drunk, so that he can gaze on their naked bodies. You will be filled with shame instead of glory. Now it is your turn. Drink and be exposed. The cup from the Lord's right hand is coming around to you, and disgrace will cover your glory. The violence you have done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, and your destruction of animals will terrify you. For you have shed man's blood, you have destroyed lands and cities, and everyone in them. Of what value is an idol, since a man has carved it, or an image that teaches lies? For he who makes it trusts in his own creation. He makes idols that cannot speak. Woe to him who says to wood, "Come to life," or to lifeless stone, "Wake up." Can it give guidance? It is covered with gold and silver. There is no breath in it. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him. In these verses, we've got the Lord's pronouncement of judgment on the Babylonians, that nation that God had appointed as the rod of his punishment of his own people, Judah. Of course, as we saw last time, Habakkuk did have great difficulty getting his head around the Lord's choice of Babylon. But today we're going to see how Habakkuk's scruples were assuaged when the fate of the Chaldeans or the Babylonians is revealed. And we can divide our text into two main sections. Firstly, verses 4-5, which give us a general description of the Babylonians, and then verses 6-20, where we have five woes pronounced against the Babylonians. Each of those woes forms a three-verse stanza. Indeed, the five stanzas combined form what is called a taunt song. The Lord is mocking Babylon, taunting them with the disaster that awaits that cruel people. First then, verses 4-5. The Babylons are successively presented as arrogant, puffed up with pride, as drunkards, wine betrays him, as gluttonous, greedy as the grave, as insatiable, never satisfied, as relentless, never at rest, as acquisitive, gathering nations to himself, and as exploitative, taking captive all the peoples. It's a very ugly picture, which was, of course, true to the reality of the Babylonian Empire. The Babylonians were indeed notorious for their boisterous feasts, with alcohol served aplenty, just like that thrown by Nebuchadnezzar's son Belshazzar, as we read about in Daniel chapter 5. And we know they were a conquering people. Never long did they rest on their laurels, but they would set off on another expedition to expand their territory. But whilst we have, of course, a picture of the Babylonians, primarily a picture of the Babylonians here, it also serves as a representative picture of the unrighteous, of the unrighteous man. He who is the polar opposite of the righteous man, who lives not by his own strength, prowess and achievement, but by trust in the Lord. So you've got that sort of contrast here between the righteous man who lives by faith and then the unrighteous, characterized by these various traits. Next we come then to our five woes. And you'll observe that each of the five stanzas begins with woe, as in not W-O-H, but W-O-E, woe, with the exception of the last stanza, where the woe is located in the middle verse. Why the change? I have absolutely no idea, so answers on a postcard, please. The woes emanate from Babylon's victims. It's now payback time. Time for the oppressed nations, including, of course, Judah, to be avenged. As we'll see, there's here a definite judicial irony. What Babylon did to others will soon be visited upon Babylon. The first woe, embracing verses 6-8, denounces Babylon for greed. The Babylonians have been guilty of extortion, plunder, and enslaving and indebting other peoples. But these other nations are now going to assert themselves and get recompense. Babylon is going to become their victims. They're now going to plunder Babylon. The second woe, verses 9-11, condemns Babylon for injustice, building its realm by unjust gain. And incidentally, you see verse 11, the stones of the wall will cry out. That line is taken up by Jesus, Luke 19, verse 40, at his triumphal entry into Jerusalem. When the Pharisees try to stop the crowds from acclaiming him as their Messiah, Jesus exclaims that even if the crowds were to keep quiet, the stones would cry out. You see, true justice and the coming of the Messiah are ultimately interconnected. Another thing to note is the reference in verse 9 to the nest on high. Alistair Begg remarks how this, for him, brought to mind Hitler's eagle's nest, situated in the picturesque Bavarian mountains, which was built in 1937 to host certain governmental and social meetings of the Third Reich. Some of the most evil men in all of history could retire to such a place of serene beauty, although Hitler himself apparently didn't much care for it because Hitler had a fear of heights. Still, as an image of injustice, Hitler and his cronies drinking tea in such a magnificent location is hard to beat. The third woe is a denunciation of Babylon's violence. You have built a city with bloodshed. The city of Babylon was indeed a city built with the booty of bloody conquest, with both gold and slave labour dedicated to the erection of a grandiose royal palace, temples, and other magnificent architecture. However, it would all prove futile in the end, for it was going to be taken by another. In the year 539 BC, Babylon fell to Cyrus, the Persian king, as another great world empire, that of the Medo-Persians, came to prominence. Of course, as verse 14 implies, in the end, all empires will give way to direct rule by the Lord. And that particular verse is actually a conflation of two verses in Scripture. Numbers 14, verse 21. Nevertheless, as surely as I live, and as surely as the glory of the Lord fills the whole earth. And Isaiah 11, verse 9. For the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Our fourth woe is against Babylon's gross immorality. Drunkenness and nakedness tend to go hand in hand. Feasts degenerate into orgies. What Babylon glories in will become a source of shame. And how fitting then that the book of Daniel tells us that Babylon's fall coincided with Belshazzar's drunken and blasphemous feast. Verse 16 reminds me very much of the expression, what goes around comes around. The cup from the Lord's right hand is coming around to you, this cup being one filled with divine wrath. Babylon would be forced to drink of that cup just as they had compelled others to swallow their oppressive ways. And this is a convenient juncture at which to pause and to tease out the first of today's two lessons. And it's this: God's judgment is always perfectly condign. That is to say, the punishment always fits the crime. Babylon's actions were subject to a boomerang effect. What they inflicted upon others was in due course inflicted upon themselves. It was tit for tat. Retributive justice was at work. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. What the Romans termed the lex talionis, the principle that a punishment should correspond to the event, to the offence, both in kind and degree. And we should not balk at this aspect of God's character and ways. God's punishment is not simply reformative, it is retributive too. People get what they deserve. And this is not just an Old Testament concept. For the Apostle Paul told the Galatians, do not be deceived. A man reaps what he sows. The one who sows to please his sinful nature, from that nature will reap destruction. Chapter 6, verses 7 to 8. Of course, we know that this is not always the case in terms of temporal punishment, punishment here and now in this life. I mean, Hitler taking his own life in his bunker hardly conforms to a fair and just outcome. But we rightly insist that God must eternally deal with all evil in such a way as perfect justice prevails. To quote Paul once more, this time from Romans, God will give to each person according to what he has done. To those who by persistence in doing good seek glory, honour and immortality, he will give eternal life. But for those who are self-seeking and who reject the truth and follow evil, there will be wrath and eternal punishment. There'll be trouble and distress for every human being who does evil, first for the Jew, then for the Gentile. Chapter 2, verses 6 to 9. So justice in this life may be viewed as penultimate justice, and that of the next life as ultimate justice. Justice may occur in this life. Babylon didn't long get away with her evil, but even where the offender gets off lightly or even scot-free, a day of reckoning awaits, for God's very character as holy and just demands it be so. To repeat, forgiveness is available to anyone who repents today, no matter how egregious their sin. But should they remain unrepentant, then they will experience eternal punishment consistent with the gravity of their personal evil. Johann Reichardt was the German state executioner during the Third Reich. He put to death over 3,000 people, including women, many occurring following a failed assassination attempt on Hitler in the final year of World War II. Reichardt even invented his own metal guillotine to speed up the executions. Following the Nuremberg trials after the end of the war, the Allied powers chose to employ Reichardt to hang leading Nazi war criminals. They did this partly due to Reichardt's expertise in the field of execution. He was unquestionably efficient at his job, but also they did it for psychological purposes, so that the Nazi war criminals who had caused the death of so many people would be put to death by their very own state executioner. That is retributive justice. However, despite the fact that he was a deeply unpopular figure in post-war Germany and he suffered personal loss, his marriage broke up and his son, his only son, committed suicide because of the association with the family name. We could hardly maintain that Reichardt himself suffered a condign temporal punishment, for he lived to be an old man, only dying in 1972. But his eternal punishment is a different matter. Back then to our text, in the final woe, verses 18 to 20. And whilst you might contest the title I gave to each of the previous woes, greed, injustice, violence, and immorality, there's no doubting that idolatry is now our focus. Idol worship was ingrained in Babylonian society. There was divination, sorcery, astrology, a pantheon of gods and goddesses, and multiple temples. There was an abundance of idols. But these idols were worthless, dumb, impotent, lifeless. They were mere man-made artifacts. They couldn't give guidance because they couldn't speak. They couldn't empower, for they were dead. Men might clothe them with the finest of metals, gold and silver, but they remained what they were, objects made out of wood and stone. And this particular stanza may well remind you of what is said by the psalmist in Psalm 115, verses 4 to 7. Their idols are silver and gold, made by the hands of men. They have mouths but cannot speak, eyes but they cannot see. They have ears but they cannot hear, noses but they cannot smell. They have hands but cannot feel, feet but they cannot walk, nor can they utter a sound with their throats. In stark contrast to these worthless man-made idols is the majestic Lord, enthroned in his holy temple. As the psalmist says again in Psalm 115, our God is in heaven. He does whatever pleases him. The only fitting response is to fall silent before him in reverent awe. As David Baker observes, lifeless idols approached in clamour are silent, while the living God approached in silence speaks. And the second lesson for today then concerns the folly of idol worship. We are very unlikely to worship the particular idols of Babylon. But idolatry is worshipping and serving the creature rather than the creator, the gift rather than the giver. That means that anything that we put before the Lord in our affections qualifies as an idol. It could be our bodies, our pleasures, our jobs, our families, our country, our football team, well, excepting Spurs. Not only joking, Spurs as well. Our iPhone, our TV, our holidays, our clothes, our car, our bank balance, even our pets. Anything at all. And let's not think that with age we outgrow the menace of idolatry. As Warren Wiersbe remarks, the only difference between men and boys is that men buy more expensive toys. Idolatry is an ever-present threat to the follower of God. There'll always be rivals jostling for our devotion. Of course, other things have their place. After all, God gave them to this world, but they should never supplant him in our core affections and loyalties. You and I know that it is a constant challenge to keep these other things at bay. But the reality is that these other things, just like Babylon's idols, cannot give life, cannot give ultimate satisfaction. Only an active, vibrant relationship with the Lord of glory can do that. And so, as we finish our third study in the book of Habakkuk, I would urge all of us, myself included, to re-examine our lives such that we root out idolatry. Let all of us recommit to a single-minded dedication to the Lord, putting him in the position of preeminence that he deserves. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him.